This evening, I'm going to be doing a lesson on archaeology. This is kind of a lesson that I've been wanting to do for a long time, but it was hard to decide what to do. There's so many things out there dealing with archaeology and dealing with scriptures. And the reason I wanted to do one on archaeology and scriptures in the first place is because the scriptures give us so much history of mankind. You know, the Bible takes us back to 6,000 years ago when God began speaking the world into existence. And then the scriptures follow a single man and then a single nation. And they give us so much history. And archaeology is interesting because it demonstrates, it shows that the Bible is accurate, the Bible is reliable. And so archaeology and the Bible go hand in hand. And it's very interesting to look at how archaeology has been demonstrating the Bible to be true. And so I've picked a number of different archaeological finds to just try to demonstrate the Bible is reliable, that it's inspired by God, that it is it's accurate. You know, one of the things that historians used to say and to question was Luke, the writer of the book of Acts and the Gospel of Luke. They said that he was, you know, he was always using the wrong words and the wrong terms, and that his geography was off. They were always accusing Luke of just not knowing what he was talking about. And then archaeology kept coming in more and more. And pretty soon they found out, you know what? Luke was right. He used the right terms. His archaeology, I mean his locations, his descriptions of cities and locations was right on. And so archaeology demonstrated that the Bible in fact was true. Demonstrated the Bible in fact was accurate. And there are so many pieces of archaeology that demonstrate this. It's honestly just hard to pick a few. The sermon that I have tonight is probably going to be spread out over a couple of sermons. And I don't even have but just a tiny bit of the archaeological evidence. I read recently, a year or two ago, maybe 3 years ago, how they found in ancient Babylon, where Babylon was supposed to be in existence, they found these giant ovens. I don't know if better, lack of a better term. Giant ovens. And Wayne Jackson, I believe it was him that was writing about it, he was commenting, isn't it amazing that we read in the book of Daniel how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were tossed into one of these things? And who would have known that archaeology was going to dig up one of these giant ovens? I'm not going to talk about those tonight, but I have some other things I want to talk about. The first one I want to talk about is from the period of Judges. If you look on this map, this is, the white is Syria, modern day Iraq, Turkey, Israel. And on this map in the white, up here you see a city called Latakia. Well, just north of that, there's a city that's now in existence which is not shown. The city is called Ras Shamra. And in the city of Ras Shamra, in the year of 1928, there was a farmer who was plowing this field, and his plow struck a rock. And so he began to dig up this dirt to move the rock out of the way of his plow, and what he found was there was a tombstone there. And so as he began to dig to get this tombstone out of the way, he kept finding more and more stuff. And pretty soon, it became one of the great archaeological finds of our time. And what he discovered accidentally while plowing in this field was the ancient city of Ugarit, which is in the current, which is in the modern day city of Ras Shamra in Syria. And in this city, in the city of Ugarit, they found a royal palace. This royal palace had, it was huge, 90 rooms in this royal palace. In the city of Ugarit, there was 8 different courtyards, a library containing numerous documents, religious documents, diplomatic documents, economic documents, administrative documents, scholastic documents, literary, tons of documents in these libraries. There were numerous private dwellings, and in fact, one writer I was reading said that these dwellings were very ambitious. He was indicating the fact that these were not poor man's homes. These were very well-to-do homes. But what's most interesting in this city of Ugarit, as they climbed the hill in the city, they found that there was 2 temples that had been buried. One to the god Dagon, and one to the god of Baal. Now you'll immediately recognize those as names from the Bible, right? We're first introduced to Baal, I believe, in the book of Judges, which is why I put that on here. I think that's the first time you see him. And you may recall the Dagon was the name of the god. Remember, you may recall the story of the Ark of the Covenant going out to battle when Eli, the priest, was still priest. And the Ark of the Covenant goes out and it's captured and is taken by the Philistines. And they place the Ark of the Covenant in the Temple of Dagon. You may recall that story that they came in the next morning and the idol of Dagon had fallen down before the Ark of the Covenant. So they pick up the idol and put him back on his stance and they come back in. This happens, I believe, three times. In the final, the third time, his hands and his feet were broken off, if I remember the story correct. But that was the God of Dagon. And we know numerous accounts of the God of Baal. The point I'm trying to make is, the Bible says that in this time frame, in this period, people were worshiping these two gods. And it wasn't until 1928, when they discovered the city of Ugarit on accident, that these things were actually confirmed. Very interesting, isn't it? The Bible told us this was the case, and years later, it was proven to be true. Here on the left, this is the entrance to what is supposed to be the royal palace, and on the right, just a partial view of the city of Ugarit. And I may be butchering that name, so don't go around trying to sound intelligent, copying me. It ain't going to work. Never, Phil says. And this right here is a memorial stone called a stele or a stela. And again, don't copy my words. Who knows? On it, and I'm not sure if you can see this, there is a figure of the storm god Baal. This was also discovered in the city of Ugarit near the Temple of Dagon. And when this was dated, it was dated to around the 18th to 15th century before Christ. And this was, again, I think I said this was discovered 4 years after the initial find. But again, demonstrating that they were worshiping a god of Baal in that time period, in that area. Here is another discovery they found in that area. This is a bronze statue of the god Baal. Dates from the time of 14th to the 12th century before Christ. And the point of this is going to be the point to every single one of my slides. The Bible is accurate. When the Bible said there were people in this area worshiping Dagon, when there were people in this area worshiping Baal, we can know it's true, not just because the Bible says it, but because we have archaeological finds that verify it, that demonstrate it was true. They were worshiping Baal and Dagon. Little interesting side note. When my wife, Paul Bedard, knows what I'm going to say. When we were having our second child, Blade, we were debating names. What do you want to name our kid? And, you know, we couldn't agree on any names. And she said, what about Dagon? I said, I'm not naming my kid after a Philistine god. And so now I, kind of interesting. I don't know if you can, what you want to do with that, but there you go. Okay, so moving on from the period of Judges to the house of David. This is Mount Hermon in the background, and you may remember hearing of that before. And discovered at Mount Hermon is this rock. This is actually three pieces. Here's one, two, and three pieces. And don't ask me which order they were discovered in, because I'm not exactly sure. But on July 21st of 1993, working under the guidance of a man named Abraham Baran, a lady named Gila Cook. And if I remember the account correct, she was actually winding down for the day, sat down to take a break, and she discovers this carving, this engraving on this rock. And she starts looking at it, and as she looks at it, she gets more and more excited and more interested, so she brings it to Mr. Abraham Baran, and he is also amazed. And so they continue working there, and in June of 1994, so almost a year later, they found two more fragments of that same stone. In just a moment, I will show you what that stone was, what that stone says on it. But just so you know, Mount Hermon is right here. So here is Judah, is, you know, what would be the kingdom of Judah, the kingdom of Israel. Christ would have gone up and down this area. Mount Hermon would be up here. So this would be the area of Syria, northern Israel. So that's where they found this piece of this archaeological find. I'm going to have some scripture up on screen. Hopefully you can all read that. This comes from 2 Kings chapter 8, beginning in verse 7. This is going to be relating to the piece, the discovery that they had found. The text says, "Now Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. And when it was told to him, 'The man of God has come here,' the king said to Hazael, 'Take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord through him, saying, Shall I recover from my sickness?' So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camel loads. When he came and stood before him, he said, "Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, 'Shall I recover from this sickness?' And Elisha said to him, 'Go, say to him, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die.' And he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was embarrassed. And the man of God wept." Real quickly, before we go to the next slide, Hazael, working for the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad, goes to the prophet Elisha, who is in the area of Syria. He's in Damascus. So he goes there and he says, "Ask him if I'm going to live." He goes in, Elisha says, "Yeah, he's going to recover from his sickness." And then Elisha starts looking at Hazael very intently. And he starts crying. And Hazael, it says, gets embarrassed. And Hazael says to Elisha, "Why does my Lord weep?" He answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with the sword, and dash in pieces their little ones, and rip open their pregnant women." And Hazael said, "What is your servant who is but a dog that he should do this great thing?" Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Syria." Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master, who said to him, "What did Elisha say to you?" And he answered, "He told me that you would certainly recover." But the next day he, Hazael, took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over Ben-Hadad's face till he died. And Hazael became king in his place. What do we have here? We have an account of how Hazael becomes king over Syria. How the prophet Elisha told him, "You're going to become king and you're going to put the nation of Israel through a lot of troubles. You're going to be a horrible person. You're going to kill women. You're going to kill children." In the same chapter of 2 Kings chapter 8, Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. So Ahaziah was the king of the southern kingdom of Judah, reigning in the city of Jerusalem. He reigned 1 year. His mother's name was Athaliah. She was a granddaughter of Omri, king of Israel. He also walked in the way of the house of Ahab and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as the house of Ahab had done, for he was son-in-law in the house of Ahab. He went with Joram, the son of Ahab, to make war against Hazael, king of Syria, at Ramoth-Gilead, and the Syrians wounded Joram. So what do we have here? We have Hazael, the king of Syria. He's going to battle against both the nation of Judah and the nation of Israel. Judah and Israel were unfortunately right now led by two evil kings, Ahaziah and Joram. Now let's get back to that archaeological find. There are 13 lines on that stone that was found. Not all of the stone is legible. Some of it had to be restored. Some of it just can't be restored. So the brackets show... I think I messed up my brackets a little bit, so... The brackets show a little bit about what's missing and what was restored. The first line says, "and cut." The second line says, "My father went up against him when he fought at, and my father lay down. He went to his ancestors, and the king of Israel," the S is missing, "entered previously my father's land, and Hadad made me king. And Hadad went in front of me, and I departed from the seven S of my kingdom, and I slew 70 kings who harnessed thousands of chariots, riots and thousands of horsemen," or horses. "I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. And I set their towns in ruins and turned their lands into desolation. Other and Jehuru led over Israel, and I laid siege upon..." Okay, now a lot of that we can't understand what exactly is happening, but we can definitely get a feel for a couple of things. Hazael was making war against the nation of Israel and the nation of Judah. And it's really interesting because we see the biblical account of how he's going to do this. We see the biblical account in 2 Kings chapter 8 that he was going to do it. They were going out against him. They've made this pact, let's go against the king of Syria. And Hazael writing, not in the biblical source, he's writing this, and he references the king of Israel, the king of Judah, the fact that there were kingdoms of Israel and Judah, but you notice he doesn't call the kingdom of Judah the kingdom of Judah, does he? He calls the kingdom of Judah the house of David. That's very significant because many skeptics for a very long time doubted whether King David ever existed, whether he was ever a real king, whether he was ever a real man. Many skeptics doubted that he ever existed. And so when this discovery was found, again, just in 1993 and 94, it was evidence for the very first time archaeologically that King David did exist. And it references, again, the house of David. But notice that there are many biblical references there. But that's probably the most significant of them all. This one is going to be a little bit more lengthy in my explanation. This one is going to be based off of an article in the Biblical Archaeology Review, the Bar magazine. And in the book of 1 Kings in chapter 16, verse 31, we read these words. "And as it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him." Before I talk about this find, we already mentioned the fact that the Bible discusses and points to the god Baal, didn't we? So again, we see a reference to something we already discussed. But looking at this slide, I want to talk about Jezebel. It says that she was the daughter of Ethbaal, and again, you notice the word Baal in his name, king of the Sidonians. The Sidonians are also called Phoenicians, and this is an area in which they ruled. The green is the area in which the Phoenicians ruled. And here is the city of Sidon and Tyre, which are both very significant cities, important cities. And so here we have Queen Jezebel, the daughter of the king of the Sidonians. And of course, we know that she marries the Israelite king Ahab. This stone seal, which is larger than most stone seals, most stone seals, I guess, are well under an inch. And this one is about one and a quarter inch, I believe, was the actual measurements, 1.23. This was donated to the Israel Department of Antiquities in 1960 from a private collection. They don't know when it was discovered or who discovered it. But it's a very interesting stone seal. And of course, in case you don't know what a stone seal is used for, it's used to seal an envelope. They would press clay or soft metal or wax over it to ensure that it was secure and to identify who sent it. And there are literally thousands and thousands of these stone seals that have been found. But according to the Biblical Archaeology Review, only 35 of the thousands and thousands that have been found, only 35 belong to women. Only 35, which is kind of interesting. According to author of this particular article, author Marjo Corpel, he said that the symbols on this are Egyptian Phoenician symbols of royalty and divinity. He says that it suggests a king or queen. And I'm going to go over the symbols a little more in a moment. He talks about the winged sphinx, the winged sun disk, the falcon. They're all symbols of royalty. The female Isis or the Hathor crown on top of the woman suggests a female owner. The double cobra on the bottom suggests a queen. And scattered out on this stone, which we would have a hard time making out because they're Phoenician letters, but there are four Phoenician letters, YZBL. Or the word Jezebel. I'm going to do my best to point out the different symbols. I hope you can see them. And you'll also have to put up with my, again, my best attempt at saying the words correctly. On the left here, okay, so this is the original stone. This is the impression. So when you have the impression, it looks how it should look. So this is actually kind of reverse, if you will. On the left here, this is an Egyptian symbol called an ankh, or ankh, and it is a symbol of life. And then just beside that, we have a female lion, or a lioness, with a Hathor crown, which was a female's crown. And according to the ones who have looked at this, who know what they're talking about, this is a woman's face. I take their word for that. A woman's face with a woman's crown and a female lion body. And again, Dr. Corpel says this definitely suggests a queen. Then the stone is divided by a line, and then there is an Egyptian winged sun disk, which he said was a symbol of royalty in Egypt. Just below the sun disk are two letters, Phoenician letters, Y and Z, or honestly, I don't know, could be Y and Z. So two Phoenician letters, Y and Z, and he says, which are written in ancient Phoenician. To the right and left of these two letters, here and here, are two cobras, which they call Uraeus. And he says that these two cobras are typical symbols of queens. But not just any queens. He goes on to explain, these are typical symbols of queens with prominent roles in religion and politics. So the queen of the Bible, Queen Jezebel, was she very involved in politics and in religion? Absolutely, she was. And also he points out that the snakes, the cobras, are frequently put on the headdresses to demonstrate that this is royalty or, again, even God's divinity. Between the two snakes, two cobras, is an Egyptian falcon, which again is a symbol of royalty. Just below the falcon's feet, here and here, is a symbol called a lotus, which is a female symbol of regeneration. Just below the tip of the wings, we have the letter L, and just in front of the lotus symbol, the Phoenician letter B. So we have YZLB, or again, the word Jezebel. And you can see these things perhaps a little better on this one. And here you see they tried to fix what they believe was the missing portion of that stone. The symbol of life, the female lioness with the Hathor crown, the female face, royalty, sun disc, the four letters Y, Z, B, L, the falcon, the two snakes, all demonstrating a female owner, royalty. And again, we remember that in their time frame, it wasn't uncommon for royalty to claim to be divinity as well. As they were writing up this article on this, Mr. Korpel talks about the fact that another expert in the field, a man named Naaman Avagard, points out the fact that the name Jezebel is a very unique name, very uncommon in this area. Not that it didn't exist, but it was very rare. And in fact, he said, some of the people who don't believe this to be Jezebel, they make this argument. They say that can't be the biblical Jezebel because it's not spelled correctly according to the Hebrew Bible. They said, according to the Hebrew Bible, there should be two more, or at least one more Hebrew letters on that stone sill. And one of the Hebrew letters is the letter Aleph, which apparently gives a throat-clearing sound. So it should be the letter Aleph, then followed by YZBL. And Marjo Korpel, the author of this article again, he said that he thinks that that would be on the top right here. And he said he also thinks that beside that Hebrew letter Aleph would be the Hebrew letter L. Because the Hebrew letter L apparently demonstrates ownership, means to belong to somebody. So he says scattered on the stone is the Hebrew letter L, meaning belonging to, the Hebrew letter Aleph, then the four letters YZBL, or belonging to Jezebel. And it seems to me it's kind of odd to scatter the letters throughout the stone, but he says that wasn't uncommon, that it was frequent, that they frequently did that. Whether that's the Jezebel of scriptures of the Bible, you know, I'm not going to make that statement. Dr. Marjo Korpel, he does. He believes it to be her without a doubt. But whether it is her or not, it again demonstrates what? That the Bible talks about there was women named Jezebel who reigned as queen. And again, it points to the fact that there were women named Jezebel who reigned as queens. So was it the same lady? Perhaps, but at least demonstrates that that wasn't an impossibility. The next and the last one I'm going to talk about tonight is going to be kind of lengthy also. And I'm going to appear to hop around a bit, and I hope hopefully you guys can stay with me on this. I want to talk first of all about Hezekiah's tunnel. I'm sure you've heard of Hezekiah's tunnel. King Hezekiah built a tunnel under the city of Jerusalem, about 100 feet down under the ground. The tunnel was about 1,800 feet long, winding in what ended up being an S-shaped tunnel to bring water from the outskirts of the city into the city of Jerusalem. This stone tunnel, this Hezekiah's tunnel, was carved through stone, limestone, and I think I already said it was about 1,800 feet long, and it was believed by most that he was doing this because he knew that the Assyrian king Sennacherib was going to be attacking him. And he was doing it in preparation so that he could last out the king's attack. He could have fresh water brought in. And so Hezekiah is known to have been the one who oversaw the workings of this tunnel. 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20 says the rest of the deeds of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So the book of 2 Kings talks about the fact that he built this tunnel. He dug this tunnel out. There was a discovery in 1830. An ancient artifact was found by a man named Taylor. And it was a prism. P-R-I-S-M, as in Matthew. A prism was found. So they call it the Taylor prism. And on the Taylor prism, Sennacherib talks about how he attacks the city of Jerusalem. He talks about that. Here's what the Taylor prism says. As to Hezekiah, the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to the 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity, and conquered them by means of well-stamped earth ramps and battering rams brought thus near to the walls, combined with the attack by foot soldiers, using mines, breaches, as well as sapper work. Himself, talking about Hezekiah, I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were leaving his city gates. The book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 32, makes this comment. It says, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and encamped against the fortified cities. So King Sennacherib of Assyria, history tells us that he came and he attacked the cities of Judah. Many cities of Judah. In fact, he says 46 walled cities of Judah he attacks. And scriptures tells us that he attacks the fortified cities in Judah. But here's something that we're going to come back to in just a minute. Here's where I'm going to jump for a second, hopefully not to lose you. We're going to come back and talk about this in a second. The city of Jerusalem itself was never taken. He simply states, I shut Hezekiah up like a bird in a cage. We'll come back to that in just a second. Going back to the Hezekiah's tunnel, I thought about just scratching this, but I thought it was kind of interesting. This was found in 1880 when a couple of boys were swimming outside the tunnel. And this is called the Siloam Inscription. The Siloam Inscription. And the inscription depicts the completion of Hezekiah's tunnel. There are a number of lines there, which it's hard to make out on the screen. But this is what it says. And this was the account of the breakthrough, or the time when the two tunnelers finally actually reached each other. And that's very interesting to read about that, how they were doing that, possible scenarios. But anyways, this was the account of their breakthrough when the two groups joined together. While the laborers were still working with their picks, each toward the other, and while there were still 3 cubits to be broken through, the voice of each was heard, calling to the other, because there was a crack or split or overlap in the rock from the south to the north. And at the moment of the breakthrough, the laborers struck each toward the other, pick against pick. Then water flowed from the springs to the pool for 1,200 cubits, and the height of the cubit above the head of the laborers was 100 cubits. So what this does is it demonstrates a little bit more about the tunnel itself. We already talked about the fact it was 1,800 feet long. They say 1,200 cubits, which is correct. About 120 feet, 100 cubits below the ground. So you can see it was a very huge undertaking. And again, the purpose of this, according to some of the stuff that I was reading, was because they were trying to prepare for Sennacherib's attempt at taking the city of Jerusalem. Going back to King Sennacherib and his attempt at taking the cities of Judah. This is a carving. I'm not sure how well you can see this. The city of Lachish. It's its outer walls. Battering rams coming up. People shooting arrows down. This is a portion of a huge wall that was discovered in the ancient city of Nineveh in King Sennacherib's palace. In his palace, in this city, he has one wall 70 feet long. And this wall is nothing but stone. And that stone is nothing but carvings of how he came in and how he conquered the city of Lachish, one of the cities of Judah. The whole wall is dedicated to look how I came in and I defeated them. Here's another picture on that wall. And you can see the Assyrian invaders are impaling Jewish prisoners. And this was not an uncommon thing from the stuff that I read, that they would do that. And here is a portion of an inscription found in his palace. It says, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, king of the world, king of Assyria, sat upon a Nemedu throne and passed in review the booty taken from Lachish. It's kind of interesting, isn't it, what he calls himself? The king of the world. He obviously has a big ego. He's obviously going to tell you about what he does, what's good. Is he going to tell you about his failures? Is he going to tell you about when he didn't do something well? I want to go back to what we said a moment ago. What we were talking about a moment ago is, where is Jerusalem's capture? He dedicates a 70-foot long piece of his palace's wall to brag about how he destroyed the city of Lachish. But the greatest city in Judah wasn't Lachish. It was Jerusalem. Why doesn't he have a huge wall talking about how he came in and conquered Jerusalem? Why doesn't he come in and why doesn't he have all these pictures demonstrating that? The reason is because it never happened. He never took the city of Jerusalem. Notice the words here in Isaiah 37. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, or shoot an arrow there, or come before it with a shield, or cast up a siege mound against it. Watch this. He shall not come into this city, declares the Lord, for I will defend this city to save it. God says in this passage, he ain't coming in. Why didn't Sennacherib talk about how he conquered the city of Jerusalem? Because he never took it. God says he wasn't going to take it, and he never did. The rest of that passage. And the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Then Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. Why doesn't he talk about his capture of Jerusalem? Because it never happens. God told him, you're not going to come in here. It's never going to happen. He's not even going to shoot an arrow. God sends out the angel of the Lord and kills 185,000 of his men. He has nothing to brag about. And in fact, the most he could say, in the Taylor prism that I already put on the screen, the most he could say is that he made Hezekiah a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. That's the most he could claim. Why is it important to study, to look at this? Hebrew writer said in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, a passage we all know very well, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The evidence. You know, we don't have faith in God just because that's what something, you know, I believe it, and so that's why it's that way. I believe it because there's evidence. I believe it because I look at science and I say there's evidence of a God. I believe it because I look at archaeology and I say the Bible's true. Look at these things. And that's why we're looking at archaeology tonight. Because it demonstrates the Bible was right. When the Bible said that they were worshiping Baal and Dagon, the Bible was right. When the Bible said there was a man named David who became king of the nation of Israel, the Bible was right. When the Bible talked about how Sennacherib was never going to enter the city of Jerusalem, he wasn't going to take it, the Bible was right. The Bible tells us that, you know, the Bible's saying it, and archaeology has said the same thing as well. If you're here tonight and you have some needs that we can be of assistance with, I know this isn't necessarily evangelistic in nature, but I think it's important to build our faith, to see that our faith is not based on just feelings, but it's based on evidences. If you're here tonight and we can help you with anything, please come and sing a song that's been selected.